Welcome to Feeling It, a podcast where we discuss TV, movies, pop culture, and whether or not we are feeling it. If this is your first time joining us, welcome to the show.
And here we go.
Come on, walk and talk.
All right, here we go.
You guys want to hear something neat?
It's showtime.
Hold your ears, folks. Here we go.
See what you can do now.
Take your position.
All right, ladies, buckle up.
Let's do this.
Hold on to your butts.
Seriously?
Listen to me very, very carefully.
Hey, it's me again.
Eat him up.
Enjoy.
Hello and welcome. This week we are chatting Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning Part 1. But before we get started, let's introduce ourselves and share your favorite quote describing Tom Cruise's character, Ethan Hunt.
My name is Sandra Amstutz, and I'm going to go with a quote from the most recent movie which Shea Whigham's character describes Ethan Hunt and says he's the mind-reading, shape-shifting incarnation of chaos.
I'm Lucas Wright from Chicago, and mine has to be Alec Baldwin's quote from Rogue Nation: "Hunt is the living manifestation of destiny," which is just—I
mean, that's a top tier. Yeah,
it's wild. I love the admiration for Ethan Hunt that literally everybody who's trying to catch him has for him. before we go deeper into Mission Impossible this week, every week we like to talk about something we've either discovered or rediscovered. So, Sandra, tell us what you're feeling this week.
So I'll be quick this week because we have so much to talk about, but I will just say that lately, not just this week, but this whole summer, I have been feeling the band Muna so hard. You know, Silk Chiffon did not come out very recently. It's been around.
Yeah.
But Silk Chiffon is my song of the summer. I am living a Silk Chiffon life every time I drive around Nashville with my windows down, which is every time because my car AC does not work. Silk Chiffon, it's their new song, One That Got Away, I think is really, really great. Muna just has like a great online presence. They have a really active TikTok account that I have a lot of fun with, where they're very loose. You know what I mean? It's not like them being cool. It's like them being goofy on their TikTok account. I don't know if you know this, but Muna also has a podcast called it's called Gayotic, and it's really charming. They're just really funny, interesting people, and I've listened to a few episodes of Gayotic. They've had Phoebe Bridgers and Lucy Dacus both, you know, on separate episodes from Boy Genius. They've had Matt Rogers and Bowen Yang from the Lost Culturistas podcast that I love. So whenever someone sounds familiar to me, I listen to that episode, and I'm having a blast with it. So I'm just kind of all Muna all the time right now.
I think they're a top-tier band. Like, really, they have solidified themselves in just constantly cranking out not only, I think, hits, but also just, like, full albums that are great. Like, they're really doing a fantastic job.
Yeah, I can't wait to see more from them because lately, like I said, I've been listening to Silk Chiffon and One That Got Away, like, back to back. Also, Home By Now, I think, is the other one that I really love. And their albums are great, but I keep wanting to find songs specifically like those three that are just, like, that have this energy to them. And so I find myself on Spotify being like, okay, songs like Muna, bands like Muna. That is what I'm, hunting for.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, perfect summer soundtrack.
Yep. So what are you feeling this week, Lucas?
Well, this week, I finally caught up and finished The Bear. Season 2.
Thank God.
I'm going to talk about it a little bit. We will go into some spoilery territory, but I'll let you know beforehand so you can skip through your chapter markers on the podcast to get something else. But I absolutely loved The Bear. I thought it was the first season. I thought the first season felt like an amazing cultural moment that everybody was in on, everybody was excited about, and it felt so chaotic in a way that we haven't really seen on TV before, at least recently, I think. season two, I was afraid that it was going to have to feel like it has to maintain that same energy. And it's just, it's a lot. It's a whole lot. Mm-hmm. And I felt like season two, they were able to really calm down a little bit, to take a breath, and really dive into characters. There's still a lot of the chaotic chef energy going on in the show, but in general, I thought they made it feel like it, like we're doing it now. We're doing a TV show. We're not just doing a mini sprint here. Mm-hmm. Lots of beautiful episodes that I want to talk about in depth. But overall, I would say this is one of my favorite seasons of television that I've seen recently. It's up there.
It's such a beautiful season of television. I think The Bear does such a great job at like peaks and valleys, where there'll be these moments of like high tension, high drama. You're like cringing, you're on the edge of your seat, and then it will take its time with episodes or with scenes. And it has like cruelty and sweetness, like all in one package. I just love how balanced of a show it is.
Yes, I 100% agree. Do you want to talk spoilers real quick for,
yes,
for some
please.
Bear stuff?
Yes, please.
Yeah, so if you haven't watched All of the Bear, I highly encourage you to do it. It's on Hulu. If you have, we're going to jump into some specific episodes. I want to highlight episode 4 real quick. This is the one where Marcus goes to Copenhagen.
Yeah.
That episode was the first one for me that's like, okay, you're going to do something different this season. You're going to dive into characters that, you know, we have known for the first season, but you're going to give us a deeper look at some of them, some of those background characters. I thought just his journey over the course of really only a few episodes, Marcus isn't one of the main focuses this season, I think. But some of the stuff that he kind of goes through and that we see from him really expands on his character. And I think also highlights some of the qualities that we absolutely love about the characters on The Bear.
And just like, I love that it takes a moment to just like talk about like what brings people to this industry, you know, and that, like you said, that this is like a quieter episode, and how it takes those scenes to just have like conversations about like what brought me here, why do I keep doing this, you know, the slow methodical act of cooking, because a lot of the scenes in The Bear are like fast paced. We're in a restaurant. Food has to get out. And yet, like with baking, you know, sometimes it's very like you just kind of keep doing it over and over, and it can be very gentle.
I think also just getting to see some of that food, like I think season one was a food show, but most of the food that we were seeing was the food that was coming out of The Bear, which they cared about and loved and everything like this. But in this season, we're also spreading that around and getting kind of a huge view of different people's perceptions of food, different types of food that people make. I think Sydney's, culinary tour of Chicago.
Yeah.
In episode 3 was, I mean, people are following her route now here in Chicago. They're
I'm
doing
sure.
the Sydney food tour.
Have you been to any of those places?
I have. I've been to most of them.
Okay. Yeah.
So it was very fun to watch. And as they pop up, you're like, yes, yes, yes.
Yeah. Have you had any of those dishes?
Yes. The breakfast sandwich that she gets at Kasama is like the quintessential, like Michelin star restaurant breakfast sandwich.
Wow.
It is truly incredible. I went the Saturday after, and there was a line 2 blocks long trying
I
to
bet.
Get in. It's insane.
Wow. Right. I think she had like a mushroom adobo there too.
Yes, yeah.
That looked incredible. Yeah.
I think this actually really does a good job of showing Chicago is like a culinary city. Like people think of Chicago around food. You know, you've got Chicago hot dogs, deep dish pizza, like those types of things. But like, there's so much food here in Chicago and so many interesting things that people are doing.
Yeah.
Fun to
see
that represented in the show.
I really want us to talk about what I think are the two best episodes of the season, which are 6 and 7.
Yes. Fishes and Forks.
Yeah.
I was not prepared for fishes. I've seen some trailers now that basically spoil every famous person who's in the show.
Oh, really? I hadn't
yes.
seen any trailers for The Bear.
One played at the movie theater before.
Wow.
Dead Reckoning.
That's wild.
And it just like had every single face. Jamie Lee Curtis was on there, Bob Odenkirk, John Barenthal, like everyone. And it's just like this, the whole point of this episode is that you don't know what's about to happen.
Yeah. I imagine, I don't know for sure, but I would hope that trailer was after the season premiered. You know what I mean? Like yes, I don't think that they were doing that trailer before the season came out. Yeah. So it was, I mean, they wouldn't have because it was a surprise to everyone. Yeah.
It's a new trailer, but I would hate to have to be planning on watching The Bear and then all of a sudden see that trailer. Yeah,
totally. So. Totally.
But yeah, I thought it was, I mean, I think it's a long episode. It's over an hour, and I could feel that at the end, but I actually think it did a really good job of like showing the emotional stress that was happening there.
Yeah.
So I was feeling it for sure. That was a one episode that night. Watch. We were just like, we're just doing six, and we need to take a break. So.
And did you know anything about what six would be like? No. Before you went in? Okay, great.
I had heard people
say, I told you it was the big episode.
Yeah, you said it was a big episode. Other people said it's a big episode, but nobody mentioned anything about it, which is
like,
great.
Yeah. I do love, like, you're binging the show, and then all of a sudden, you're going a whole episode 5 years back. Like,
yeah.
That time jump is, I think, so cool because season one did have a flashback to when Mikey was alive, but it was very brief.
Yeah.
And then when you realize, like, oh no, we're doing a whole episode with the Berzados.
Yep.
Like, another thing I love about that episode is I really love movies and television that have a giant family all under one roof and like the chaos of that. I like it when it's heartwarming, like something like Dan in Real Life is a movie I've always loved where they, you know, are all together in a vacation home. But I also love it when it's really tense and uncomfortable, like August Osage County.
Yeah.
And this, I think, has a blend of both of those. You know, there are scenes in this episode, like the scene between Richie and Tiff, that are just so sweet and lovely. And there's so many like funny, charming moments, especially with Maddie Matheson, Neil Fack, you know, and Sarah Paulson and John Mulaney are having a lot of fun in this episode.
Yeah.
But then you have just like the most edge of your seat, tense moments with Jamie Lee Curtis. And yeah, that roller coaster was so fun for me.
Yeah, as someone who like has never done any of these like massive family dinners or anything like that, they're always so, they feel interesting to watch because, like you said, like there's the chaos, there's the tension, but then there's also all of the really sweet moments layered in there that make it feel like a family. It doesn't make it feel like, why is anybody still here? None of this.
Why are they subjugating themselves?
Right, exactly,
to this?
Exactly. Yeah. And so, but yet you feel the love that's constantly, you know, in between all these characters in the midst of all that tension. So, yeah, I absolutely loved that episode and just basically had to go on a walk afterwards.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, like, I think John Mulaney is kind of like, when I watched, so I was home recently, and I wanted my mom to watch The Bear. And so we watched season one and two together, which was great because I got to rewatch all of this.
Yeah.
And John Mulaney and Jamie Lee Curtis were the two faces that she recognized in that, of the cameos, you know? And John Mulaney comes out first. And when John Mulaney comes out, you know, like, I think that's the big reveal for a lot of people who, might not know who Sarah Paulson or, like, Bob Odenkirk is. Anyway, John Mulaney gets to have so much fun, in between this, in these small scenes where he's walking in and out, and then delivers the most beautiful monologue.
I was so impressed by it, honestly.
Yeah.
And like they'd done it such a good job of having him be kind of the comic relief, the guy who, you know, it's just water off his back the entire evening. He's just there to observe. And then him actually being able to talk through his observations of the family was just a really sweet moment that I didn't expect them to give him.
I know. And I'm trying to think of like what acting John Mulaney has done. I know he had like a failed sitcom.
Yeah.
And I know he's been on Pete Holmes's Crashing, playing basically like a version of himself.
Yeah.
But this made me want to see like John Mulaney, the actor.
I know. I'm curious.
And then Sarah Paulson also just like,
yeah.
God, I love her. Just killing it. I was obsessed with this episode. Jamie Lee Curtis, I think, is like really overwhelming, but that's, I think, intentional. And, I was very happy to see her like reappear at the very end of the season.
Yes, definitely. I didn't know if anyone was going to come back.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. In Forks, they bring back Gil's for a phone call. And so after that, I was like, are we going to piece in any of these people?
Yeah.
And I'm glad we got Jamie Lee Curtis at the
end. One thing I wanted to bring up, now that I've watched season two twice, I loved watching it again and seeing how things have been seeded throughout the whole season. And one of those things is in like the first or second episode, you know, the bear does a lot of things where we'll do like a flash cut of like photos on a desk, whiteboard, Chicago, cityscape, you know, like kind of really quickly. And in one of those, there were photos of young Jamie Lee Curtis, like in the mass of, you know, family photos that were
in
shown.
Season one?
No, in episode one.
Oh, in episode one. Okay, I was like, wow, that's impressive.
Yeah, no, that would have been really impressive. No, but at the beginning of the season, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, it was right there in front of us.
That's
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That Jamie Lee Curtis was coming, that she was right there. I mean, it was Jamie Lee Curtis, a famous face. And yet, because it's like a nostalgic, homey, old photo, you know, you don't pay that much attention to it.
Yeah.
Another thing that I love that was seeded throughout this season was Taylor Swift.
Yes, yes. Which brings us to Forks.
Yeah.
Yeah. They kept talking about Taylor Swift, mostly Richie and his, you know, his daughter.
Yeah.
And I really thought that was a fun character, just piece to add in. Like,
did you notice in Fishes that Jillian Jacobs was wearing a 1989 t-shirt?
Yes, I did.
Yeah. So great. And I love that. It's like, no, Taylor Swift isn't mentioned in that episode.
No.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And she's wearing like something over the t-shirt too. Like it's kind of obscured, but I love that character story of this is a woman who loves Taylor Swift. And so her daughter is her 5-year-old daughter is like a Taylor Swift fan.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah.
The way that they kind of seed in those things and then really pay it off in big moments it's done beautifully throughout the entire season. But I just think Forks hits hard.
Forks really hits so hard. And it's such a nice salve after the cut of Fishes.
And I think it's interesting because it's like you knew Richie had to go on a journey since the beginning of the first episode where he's like, what's my purpose?
Yes.
You're like, this guy's going to go somewhere this season.
Yeah.
But it's an unexpected one, and yet it makes a ton of sense. Like, I want to go back and see season one and see like how much service, how much connection means to him in those earlier episodes.
Yeah.
But throughout this, I believed it when I was watching Forks. I was just like, I believe that he's excited about this now.
I got a chance to do that. And ultimately what they said is true is that his character is a people person. Like his skills are not the managing of the restaurant and the office work and, you know, like those, that's why the restaurant was in chaos, is because he's the kind of guy who had been trying to run all of it. His skills are like being friendly and charming with people. And in season one, you know, he's the one at the counter usually, and he's the one who is remembering people's order and asking how they've been. He's the one who like goes out to the shady guys on the sidewalk and like makes the deals, you know. Even in season two, when he's messing up, when he's like stealing electricity from the neighbors, they're like, you're stealing electricity from the neighbors. He's like, no, I'm borrowing it from a friend. And it's like, I do believe that he is friends with the neighbors, you know. So it is seated, even whether it was intentional or not, you know.
And I think having the Olivia Colman of it all coming in at the very end of that episode, again, not expected. And also, I think up until that point, at least I wasn't expecting, we're going to meet Chef Terry. We're going to meet Chef Terry. Even though people kept talking about her the entire episode, it didn't feel like that was what we were building to. And so that nice, sweet moment where they just get to sit and peel mushrooms and chat, I thought was beautiful.
Yeah, it really was. And it's like, that's what this show, you know, I think I'd heard there's all these cameos of these famous people, but I feel like they really use them so expertly.
Yeah.
And having someone like Olivia Colman come in for just that one scene.
Right.
But making it such an impactful scene, it's like putting their money where their mouth is, you know?
Right. Yeah.
One little detail about that episode, again, because I had heard going into Forks that there was a big cameo. That's all I knew.
Yeah.
No other details. And then when they were announcing, like, who the VIPs were for the night, and they said Bo Burnham. I was like, oh my God, Bo Burnham is in this episode. So I'm glad instead we got Olivia Colman. And the Taylor Swift moment it's just so joyous. And what I like about that is, like, Taylor Swift music, it's so recognizable. It's so upbeat, or like, you know, like the big poppier ones are so upbeat that it almost feels like a cheat to use her music in a movie or a TV show, right? Because it does something to, like, the brain chemistry so, like, easily. But this whole show is, like, so, like, not afraid to use music in powerful ways. But what I love is that there's the line earlier in the season where Richie says, like, to his daughter, like, and I love Taylor Swift, I just needed a break.
Yeah.
And at first, that just sounds like a funny line that you, like, say to your kid to, like, because your kid loves Taylor Swift, right?
Yeah.
And you're trying to be nice to your kid. But the payoff that, like, no, Richie actually does kind of love Taylor Swift is so charming and makes him, like, such a lovable, interesting character.
And again, it makes it more than just a sound cue. It makes it truly, like, character motivated, which just it just makes everything so much better.
Right. And someone that I saw online pointed out that also the fact that while he's singing that, he's also, like, has road rage and is yelling
he's still
at people,
Richie.
And that he's still himself. Right. Yeah. This isn't just like. That's what makes the whole thing feel authentic, that it's not just like, oh, our, like, cursing, you know, badass character now is all of a sudden singing Taylor Swift, you know,
right.
Which can be funny, but, like, doesn't always feel authentic.
Yeah.
This felt very authentic.
Yeah. And I think even in the following episode when he starts wearing suits and everybody's like, oh, you're wearing, and he's like, yeah, I wear suits now. And it's not like I changed my personality. It's not, it's just like, I'm doing this thing that makes me feel better about myself. And that's what I need. And everybody's 100% on board with it and also feel like it fits him well.
Yeah. So I love in that episode when he goes to the table and he asks if anyone wants some Bacardi and diet.
Yes. Yes.
Oh God. It made him, he's just so charming. He's so fun.
Yeah.
Now that you've seen the season, I know that you're not as online as I am, but I want to know if you have heard any of, like, the, you know, conversation about shipping the characters on The Bear.
Yeah. So I mean, I have heard people talk about shipping Carmi and Sydney, and I feel like we've talked about this before. I love a relationship. What I think ends up happening too often is we get work relationships that turn into romantic relationships, which isn't inherently a bad thing. But I just love seeing working relationships where people respect each other without there having to be any, I don't know, flirtation, sexual chemistry, any of that stuff.
Right.
I think it's more interesting this way. Especially with what they're doing with Carmi, where he feels like he can only focus on the restaurant. What he takes away at the end of this season is, I think, the wrong thing. But that mindset of, like, if I can't do this 100%, I can't do anything else.
Yeah.
And I don't think you could explore those things if there was some workplace chemistry there at this point in the show, is how I feel.
Yeah. You know, I was really surprised. And I don't know how much of this is because people ship Sydney and Carmi so much, or if it was just, like, an actual genuine reaction. But I saw on Twitter a lot of hate towards Claire, his love interest of the season. People, like, did not like, a lot of people did not like that performance, did not like that relationship. And I felt completely the opposite. I was so like enamored by their chemistry, Molly Gordon and, you know, Jeremy Allen White. I found that whole storyline to be really interesting. And like the idea of, let's say you meet someone and they seem perfect for you and they're kind and loving and like, and yet there's something within yourself that you just can't let it happen and let it be good. You know, yeah. I loved exploring that. And I thought the Molly Gordon's character was like a really great way. You know, she wasn't a main character of the show, right? Like, so yeah. We only got to see her in relation to Carmi. And yet there had been some criticism that she has like kind of a manic pixie dream girl energy. And I don't agree with that. I think she feels like a real grounded character in this universe. Like, you could see her being this like doctor in Chicago. Like, she feels like she fits in that way. And yet she still obviously is like beautiful and special in this, you know, relationship. And I was really, really into it. And I wonder how you felt about just that relationship in general.
Yeah, I like it. I think it's difficult to compare like a character that we've seen really only in like 3 episodes.
Sure. You know,
before the end of the season, if you're like, how do we feel about her? We've seen her in 3 episodes again, basically through Carmi. We're not getting flashbacks to her life. We're not as deeply involved in her character as we are in everyone else on the show. So I can totally see why people are like, she's not developed enough in reality. It's like, she's a very peripheral character we're using to explore Carmi's relationship with himself and, you know, his work.
His personal life.
Right. Exactly. And so I liked the relationship. I never thought about it as something that was like manic pixie-esque. I felt she worked perfectly in what they were trying to do.
Yeah. As far as Sydney goes, personally, you know, I'm a romantic. I do like having romances in workplace like shows. One, because like that does happen a lot, you know, like that feels very real. And especially in a restaurant, like people are hooking up in restaurants.
For sure.
And I appreciate it more in a workplace show than I do a show about a group of friends, because how often, when you have like a core group of friends, how often does everyone date each other? That doesn't seem as common to me.
Right.
But in a workplace show, it does feel very, you know, realistic. With Sydney, I agree with you. I've always felt like that her relationship with Carmi is so pure, in that it's about like this connection they have as colleagues and peers, as like they recognize each other's talent, they recognize a similar drive and passion in each other, and I don't yet have like a sexual romantic chemistry. Now, you know where I do kind of sense like a little tension and chemistry is between Sydney and Richie. That seems like the kind of thing where you play the long game, and like, who doesn't love, like, you know, rivals to lovers? Like, it's a dynamic that's tried and true.
It is a great dynamic. I don't see it yet, but I mean I'm not gonna say it'll never happen.
Let me tell you, rewatch it, Lucas, with this in your head, and you will see it. Because there are moments in season one, but especially in season two, when he comes in with the suit and she like kind of takes him in, and then she says to him, "You smell good," you know, not just "you look good," but "you smell good." Anyway, that's what I'm rooting for. And, I'm also, intrigued by the whole like Marcus Sydney, you know, debacle, you know, the idea that he obviously like has this crush on her. They obviously have this like relationship and chemistry, and what happens when that becomes incredibly awkward. And, I'm intrigued at how that could play out in the future.
Yeah, me too.
One other thing I wanted to tell you that I saw seeded through all of season two was the fridge. It comes up multiple times in episodes where it's like, Carmi, we need to get the fridge. And he tries to call the fridge guy and it doesn't happen. But even at the beginning of episode one, it's like almost every episode, there's a shot of a whiteboard that says like, fix the fridge.
Yeah.
Like it's constant. And I just love that it's seeded so much and then it has like just the hugest payoff.
Yeah. I really loved it. I was worried about that last episode just to try and figure out, like, in my head, it's like, we're going into the finale.
Yeah.
This is either going to go well or it's going to go poorly, and I just can't handle it if it goes poorly. And I really liked the balance of, like, it did go well, objectively.
Right.
The chaos that happened in the kitchen leading to him ending up in the fridge.
Yeah.
I don't know. It just deepened it in a way that I really, really enjoyed, and I'm excited to rewatch.
Right.
And the ending of them just yelling at each other on either side of that door.
Oh, heartbreaking.
Heartbreaking and also just very beautiful. Like Richie just like yelling, I love you, I love you.
Yes. Like, to go through episode 6 and 7with the family yelling at each other, and then to go through like this journey with Richie where you're just like so in love with him, mm-hmm. and then to see Carmen yelling the things at Richie that Bob Odenkirk's character was yelling at Mikey.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
To see him, like, repeating that behavior was so brutal. Because, like, you love Carmi. You want to root for him. And to see him, you know, destroy things is hard to watch. Yeah.
But I think it leads us into a very interesting season three run.
Yeah.
That I'm excited for. I think at the end of season one, I liked it and was very I knew I wanted to see a season two, but I didn't know kind of how they would do a season two well.
Right.
And at this point, I now trust the show. And I'm just like, I'm so pumped for season three. Just take your time, whatever you guys need. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's my now that Succession is done, it's my favorite currently airing show.
Yeah.
Same. I'm so glad that you've watched it now.
All right. Well, this is the 7th Mission Impossible film and the 3rd with Christopher McQuarrie in the director's chair. So they have been hyping this movie for almost a year. And at this point, I was avoiding all information connected to this movie. So I didn't see any of the posters or trailers or anything like that. But I'd love to hear from you, Sandra, about your perception of this movie going into it. Having watched all the other Mission Impossible movies, having seen the marketing up to this movie, what was your thought going in?
I was really stoked. I love the Mission Impossible movies. I'm trying to remember when I first saw them all. I kind of did a binge, maybe like at the beginning of the pandemic.
Yeah, me too.
I think I binged all of them. And I adore this franchise. I think, you know, we'll probably talk about our ranking at some point, I imagine, in this conversation, like we usually do with Fast and the Furious.
Yeah.
But with Fast and the Furious, I can pretty easily rank them because there's varying levels of quality, I would say.
Yeah.
And that's franchise. With this one, I have such a hard time because I love them so equally. Like each movie has its own special, you know, either stunt or storyline that really connects with me. I just have just a never ending passion for them. So I was super excited for this movie. I'm sure I had seen a trailer, but the trailers were pretty good at not giving away too much, at least what I can remember seeing. Because there's just it's just so much action and so little plot, you know, in a Mission Impossible trailer. I didn't feel like spoiled going into this. I knew the cast mostly because I see a lot of like the promo on, you know, on the internet of like the interviews and the red carpets and all of that. So the cast was more like what I was very familiar with going in. I knew like certain people that were coming back from previous movies. And I knew like who the new additions were. And I was excited by all of them. So, yeah, I was, you know, high expectations going in.
Yep. And you did a full rewatch, right? You watched all the Mission Impossible movies?
I rewatched all of them except for two. Mission Impossible 2, the first time I remember it being kind of a slog, and so I just didn't rewatch it this time. I was like,
yeah, we'll get to our rankings, but for me, that's the one that's like the big dip in quality. Like, right. For me, they're all, I would rank them all very close to each other, and then Mission Impossible 2 is.
But even that one has elements that I remember being fantastic. For sure. Yeah.
It's absolutely still fun.
Yeah. Yeah, so I rewatched all of them, and I had a blast doing so. I rewatched all of them, and honestly, like, I have friends that I'm trying to convince to watch all of them, and I would rewatch them right over again. Like, I felt
the exact same way. I watched them. We did a movie marathon here and did like one and two on a Friday night, and then 3, 4, 5, 6 on the Saturday. We just took the entire day and watched all four of them in one day.
Yeah.
And afterwards, I was like, that was like, I'm tired. And then I woke up the next morning and was ready to watch them again. They're good. Yeah.
They're so fun. Good. So good.
Well, in that case, let's rank them. Let's rank them in advance, and then later we can talk about where this movie falls.
Okay.
But going into this movie, what was your ranking?
Okay. Well, I'm not going to have anything insightful to say here, because honestly, the new movie doesn't change much for me in that Mission Impossible 3 is my favorite. I can play Mission Impossible 3 over in my mind and be thrilled. Like, I love that movie. I discovered recently that a lot of people think it's the worst, and that baffles me.
Wild.
Yeah.
Absolutely wild.
So Mission Impossible 3 is my favorite. I think 4 has a lot of things that I find really charming. So that might be my second favorite. But really the thing is, 3 is my favorite, 2 is my least favorite, and then the rest are kind of very equal.
Yeah.
So the ranking is not – my ranking could change any day because the rest are so equal. I would probably say 4, 6, 5, 1, 2 maybe.
Okay. Yeah.
After that, yeah.
Yeah. I feel similarly there. Like, for me, 3 I think is my favorite, but for me – the third one, the sixth one, which is Fallout, and then the first one, the first Mission Impossible, all three of those are on a similar tier. Like, I would rank them about the same.
Yeah.
And then below that, barely below that, I would have, like, Rogue Nation and Ghost Protocol.
Yeah.
And then at the bottom, for sure, is definitely Mission Impossible 2. But I agree with you that, like, a lot of them are so close.
Right.
In quality that I enjoy them all.
I think the thing is, the McQuarrie films are so impressive, but there's also a heaviness to them. Whereas, like, Ghost Protocol and 3 have a lightness to them that I really love. You know, there's a lot more humor in those two.
So all that to say, how did you feel about Dead Reckoning Part 1?
So I saw Dead Reckoning Part 1 in IMAX, and it is incredible. It's so thrilling. I have some issues. I have some complaints. But on the whole, I had such an amazing time. And I was so... I found the stunt work to be so thrilling that I would rewatch this movie over and over. I have seen it twice so far. And the second time, it's honestly, I think it's even better the second time around.
Yeah.
And I just think that this is an incredible piece of filmmaking. I can't ever wrap my mind around how they're able to pull off all these, like, long, extended set pieces.
Mm-hmm.
I think Tom Cruise is still Tom Cruise. I mean, he's just...
Yeah.
And that, like, Tom Cruise still being able to do what Tom Cruise does at this age is a miracle.
Yeah.
and I don't just mean the stunts, by the way. I do mean, like, the amount of intensity and charisma he is able to bring at, like, such a consistent level, and consistent across these films he's something else, you know?
It's really insane the amount that he continues to push himself for these things.
Yeah.
I think one of his favorite things besides actually making these movies is the prep work for all of these stunts. Like, yeah. I just think he enjoys the process of all of this so much.
Yeah. I've said it before, I'll say it again. I think Tom Cruise is a complicated and yes. problematic individual. And so I'm hesitant to praise him too much. But it is undeniable, like, how talented he is. And if we're going to watch Tom Cruise movies, which I have resigned myself that I will, because these movies are so good.
Yeah.
I would be interested to see what a Tom Cruise directed movie looks like.
I've never thought about that before. That would be interesting.
I think he has all of the experience that would, you know, think he's just as experienced. I mean, I think he essentially does direct a lot of the movies he's in, you know, like he's so powerful that he is doing he has a lot of that control, you know? Yeah.
And I think my assumption would be he likes that from producers. Perspective of like having that control,
yeah,
but not being the person who cares about the, you know, the camera, the lens, the color, like all sure. of those things. It's more just like he wants to be in charge of the emotional weight of the movie.
So. From what I've heard in interviews, I do think he is like a camera nerd.
Yeah,
I mean, vaguely from what I've heard, you know, like I'm not an expert, but I think my scenario of this is like Tom Cruise, like, let's say, God forbid, I'm not saying I wish this upon him, but, like, let's say he has, like, a really bad injury in a mm-hmm. stunt, right? And he can't, and he needs to take a break, you know, not saying, like, he can never return, you know, yeah. but, like, what if he directed a movie in between acting gigs, you know? I just think that would be fascinating.
It would be very fascinating to see.
Yeah. Anyway, it's just something for us to think on.
Yeah, definitely.
Another thing I just want to say about this movie before we get into spoilers is there is a lot of new talent in this film. Most of it, I was really, really, like, blown away by. Hayley Atwell and Pom Clementeith are such welcome additions. I was blown away by both of them. Particularly Pom Clementeith, though. Like,
yeah.
She is so amazing in this movie. I don't know if it's a spoiler to say that she's, like, one of the, you know, antagonists, guess.
Yeah, you can definitely say that.
She's one of, like, the villains, antagonists in this movie. And that is such a rarefied a space in Mission Impossible. Like, you're competing with Philip Seymour Hoffman and most recently Henry Cavill, you know, and who have both, I think, delivered incredible performances. And she is up there with them, in my opinion. Like, her almost like feral animal energy that she brings to this character was delicious. I loved every scene with her.
I agree with you. I wish she was more of a character.
Yeah.
I wish she had more lines. She's a fairly silent character for the most part. And I just wanted a whole lot more of her. But she was fantastic in this. Like, you couldn't take your eyes off her the entire time.
Yeah. And Hayley Atwell is, like, she's a movie star.
Yeah.
To hold her own with Tom Cruise in so many scenes. I think the difference that really surprised me in this movie is that, you know, Tom Cruise will have people share the scenes with people, right? But it's like the scene is, whenever Tom Cruise is in the scene is really about Tom Cruise.
Yes.
And in this movie, Hayley Atwell feels like she is on the equal level to him in the scenes that they are in. Like, that we want to watch Hayley Atwell just as we want to watch Tom Cruise in whatever the sequence is. I was really, really excited by this addition and where that, you know, what the future holds for her character.
I agree. I thought she was fantastic, and I thought she's a very different kind of character mm-hmm. in all ways than we've had in this franchise before.
Yeah.
Which was very exciting for me.
Yeah. I have a lot more to say about that.
So much more.
I do want to get into some of the problems I had with this movie, and I wonder if you had any criticisms that were glaring, maybe.
Yeah, I think for me, There's some that are hard to talk about without getting into spoilers. But yes. I think just in general, coming back to Hayley Atwell, just has an interesting time with women. The history of this franchise.
Yes.
With the women in these movies. And so I think it's interesting. I'm curious, again, I hate to rant about this is a part one, and I'm very tired of part one movies at this point. I would love for someone to just finish a movie. And so I feel like there's so much that I'm not going to be able to judge this movie on because I don't know how it ends. And so I have a lot of questions and concerns that could possibly be addressed in the next movie. But I just think the way that it handles women in this franchise has been problematic. And in this movie, I don't think was particularly great, even with the amount of women in this one. Is technically, right. I think, more than all the others. So
sure. Yeah, we can talk more about that in spoilers, but I would say I agree with you. I also would say this movie has a villain problem. It has two villain problems, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I really am struggling with how much I can say before spoilers. I guess I'm so invested in these action movies having good villains. I think it can make or break a movie. And part of the reason Mission Impossible 3 is my favorite is because Philip Seymour Hoffman is one of the best movie villains I've ever seen.
Great.
And so it has like a high standard to compete against, right, within its own franchise.
Yeah.
And so the villain issue here... Do we know for sure is, so this is a part one, right?
Yep.
Is Dead Reckoning part two, is that supposed to be the last Mission Impossible movie?
That's what they said. And then recently in an interview, Tom Cruise said he would love to continue to make more of these. So.
Well, okay. I mean, I want more Mission Impossible movies.
I do too.
So I don't want to be mad at that. But the way they're setting up this villain, it really seems like this needs to be the end, right. Story-wise.
Agreed.
Yeah, I'll save some more of my thoughts for spoilers. I'll just say that, like, I struggled with aspects of, like, the villains in this movie. And, yeah. But I will also compliment it and say, of all the part ones we've had this year,
yeah,
I do feel like this one had a satisfying ending.
It was the closest to an ending.
Yeah.
Out of the part one movies, yes.
So I appreciate that, and I, you know, compliment it on that. I think I'm mostly just really excited to get into spoiler territory with you.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I think we'd both definitely recommend this movie, but yes. I think everything else that we want to talk about needs to be behind a spoiler bumper. So,
right.
All right, let's talk spoilers.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
Are you paying attention?
It's your last chance to walk away.
Let me tell you what's going to happen.
No, cracking gas.
Spoilers!
Remember, you wanted this.
Let's talk about the villains and get the negative out of the way.
The entity.
The entity. Gosh, I mean, it's so hard for the villain to, the big villain ultimately is the entity, right?
Mm-hmm.
To not be a person, to be a concept ultimately, you know, like to be this shapeless. It's like, why? Did an AI become, why is this AI so, like, cruel, you know? Like,
yeah.
Why is it villainous? Yeah. I have a hard time thinking of, you know, a movie like iRobot, right, it justifies why AI, like, wants to kill people, right? It says, like, yeah, for the good of humanity, like, I'm going to do all these villainous things. I don't understand why this AI... has what its motive is ultimately.
Yeah, I agree with you there. I think there's a lot of dialogue in the first like half of this movie talking about all of those things, but in a way that I couldn't keep up with and catch.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know if it was because there was so much else going on that I was just focused on. Usually the plots don't matter. And in this one, the plot kind of doesn't matter, but the actual motivation for the AI was something that I missed. I think it felt very generic in the way that just like, I don't know, AI just wants to make the world better. And it turns out the best way to make the world better is to kill these humans, like that kind of stuff that just ends up happening in a bunch of AI movies. Those kinds of things felt predictable, but this feels so engineered and Like it's torturing Ethan in a way that feels that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, like why? What does the AI have it out for Ethan specifically?
Yeah.
And then also it's like, okay, so the AI has these like human followers that like are like worshiping it essentially.
Yeah. Again, we didn't get a lot of detail there. I think.
Confusing.
It's extremely confusing. I think this is also something that... Did you watch Westworld season, like, 3?
No.
Okay, season 3 does this exactly, where an AI takes over. It has humans that it talks to, basically, who are working on their behalf. And it just does it, like, it didn't work there either. like it's just a weird concept for people to get on board with, and it makes those characters not really characters, because if they're just doing whatever the AI wants, there's no... actual human motivation that we can really track in a way that makes them boring. So
because like with the previous movie with the syndicate, you know, like that I can understand like a charismatic, like psychotic, you know, terrorist essentially who like gains a following and apostles, right? Yeah. As they were described.
Yeah.
Like that makes sense to me. And, but being these two people, right? The Gabriel character and the Paris character being these apostles of an AI, for what reason? Like we have, it was just kind of like, you know, a nothing.
Yeah.
Also, like, it's so hard not to cringe when they say the phrase, the entity.
Yeah. And they say it so much.
Yes. I don't even know if I mind that much. Like, that's kind of the fun of these movies is, like, the silliness sometimes. But especially when Rebecca Ferguson would say it. Like, it was when it was really, like, her seriously saying, like, the entity. I actually loved the opening scene with all of the, like, intelligence directors describing it.
Yes.
That felt kind of, like, eerie and sci-fi and melodramatic in a cool way.
Yeah. I liked it. It was too many famous cameo people in one room for me to pay attention to what they were saying. I was like, oh, it's Chris Parnell. Oh, it's Mark Gatiss.
Chris Parnell.
Or no, Charles Parnell, sorry.
Oh, okay.
Chris Parnell was not in that room, no.
Okay. Is he on SNL? Is that who I'm thinking of?
Chris Parnell, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. I'm really like, you really threw me for a second, the idea that Chris Parnell was in Mission Impossible.
You did not miss it. Charles Parnell, who was in Top Gun Maverick.
And Rob Delaney.
Rob Delaney was in there, yeah.
And then I need to learn her name, the actress that was in that scene.
Indira Varma?
Yes.
Yeah, because she's in a lot of great stuff.
Good in that scene too.
Oh yeah, like, she was fantastic.
So
I need to watch it again because I was so distracted by all of them. I was just like, oh my gosh, all these people are in this movie. I didn't know they were going to be in one scene. But
let me tell you, that scene was incredible because I loved how like melodramatic all the dialogue from all of them was.
Yes,
and then you have like the creepiest looking guy coming in, and they did such a good job of making it think like he works for the entity.
Right. Exactly. They keep talking about the, like the acolytes or whatever.
Yes. And it was, and his face was so good.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I've never seen that actor before, but he has such a great like villain face. Mm-hmm. And then the creepy little glasses that he put on and that green dust was so cool. I mean, that whole sequence from the time they start describing the entity to the time Ethan Hunt leaves dressed as Kittredge.
Yep.
I was obsessed.
Yeah.
Plus excellent having kickoff. Kittredge back. Now, did you know that Kittredge was coming back?
I think I'd seen a tweet that said he was back.
Yeah. I knew coming in. They had promoted that heavily. Like, not just in trailers, but in, like, posters and announcements. Okay. And, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd seen something that he was in this movie, but I didn't know if it was just going to be a cameo or how involved he was going to be.
Yeah. That was exciting.
Yeah, that is great.
Okay, really quick. The other villain problem I have is that I did not like the performance of the character of Gabriel.
Really?
Yeah. It really didn't work for me. To me, it was so stiff, and it almost made it seem like he was not a human. And I don't see that being – I don't think that that's going to be the case. I think, like, that the character is a human.
Yep.
One, I don't see Mission Impossible doing that. And two, like, they're seeding that, like, Ethan has this history with him from long ago. But the way he's performing it, it's like, it feels very either robot-like or alien-like. It feels like he doesn't know how humans act or speak.
Yeah.
He moves so slowly.
Yes.
the fight sequences with him, I don't think are super compelling. He overall did not work for me.
I didn't mind him. I mostly just thought his character was a nothing character.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to get emotionally connected to him in any way as a villain. I think the most they try to do is give that little flashback of saying it sounds like he killed someone that was close to Tom Cruise at some point.
Yeah, but that Tom Cruise might have gotten blamed for that murder.
Yeah, exactly. But other than that, we know nothing about him. He doesn't feel like he has any motivation. And because we can't really tell what the entity is trying to do at different points in this, it just feels like he just kind of shows up, says stuff or does stuff without us really understanding it. And you're right. He's slow. He's methodical in a way that I think they're trying to get across, that like he knows what's happening and he, you know, he doesn't care. He's not in a rush, like all of this stuff that just makes him feel more boring.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I did like his fight scene. It feels like one fight scene, but with Hayley Atwell and Rebecca Ferguson on the bridge.
Blech. No, I did not like that one. I was kind of into him and Ethan on the train. Like,
yeah,
but the fight scene with Rebecca Ferguson. I mean, let's get into, I guess, that scene.
Yeah.
I'm pretty bitter.
I am extremely upset that Rebecca Ferguson dies in this movie.
here's the thing. I think one of two things happens, and I'm mad at both of them.
Yeah.
Either the character is really dead, and I'm really mad at that.
Yes.
Or the character isn't really dead, and I'm annoyed at that.
I 100% agree with you there. I was talking through that as well. I was like, I want her to be back, so I don't want her to be dead.
Yeah.
But it's so dumb if that's actually what happens. And if she is dead, I'm just pissed because this makes it makes no sense. It feels like something that like Rebecca Ferguson wanted out. Like she doesn't want to do these movies anymore.
Maybe, yeah.
But I also, I don't know. Like she's one of my favorite characters in this series. So she is the coolest character. She's so interesting. And I feel like we haven't gotten enough of her that I was excited to finally, like, if we were done with all of the chaos surrounding her, like in Rogue Nation and Fallout, half of the movie is like her trying to get back in with MI6 or trying to get free of all of that. And I was like, she's free now. Now we can actually dig into her character. And instead we're just going to kill her.
And what makes her that character so fascinating in 5 is that it's almost like for the first time in the whole series, Ethan has met his match in talent. Like, she is the British Ethan Hunt. Like, she is the female Ethan Hunt. She is the person that is just as good as he is at spy fare, you know?
Yeah.
And it's thrilling to see, like, this character that is, like, such a superhero meet their equal. And it's also incredibly romantic.
Yep.
And I feel like they have this simmering romance across multiple movies that I thought was really cool. The fact that you would kill that character and deny him, like, you know, a happy ending with this character. But also the fact that we never get to see them kiss is a crime. Why would you build all of that romantic tension in just to kill her and not even let them kiss? It's honestly I actually don't understand why they would do that.
I also think it's baffling, but it also sounds like you think they should have kissed beforehand and then they could kill her off.
I don't think they should have killed her off at all.
Yeah, agreed.
But why kill her off and never even let that kiss happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree.
Like, that just doesn't make... And especially in this movie, like, in the previous movies, I think there's romantic tension, right? She's saying, like, run away with me, ultimately, right?
Yep.
But there's nothing, like, really physical that happens between the two of them.
Yeah.
And then this movie, there's all this physical affection that implies that they are a couple.
Mm-hmm.
but we've never seen them kiss? What? I really am just so confused by, like, what they're just, like, why they did that, you know?
Yeah.
And then ultimately sad and angered that she is not a part of this movie anymore.
Yeah. Does Tom Cruise kiss in Top Gun Maverick?
Yes. He has sex in Top Gun Maverick.
Well, I they don't show it. They show him, like, yeah, taking his shirt, like, off or whatever. But, like, do we actually see...
They show them, like, falling into bed, you know?
But do,
like,
we see them actually kiss?
Yes.
Okay, we do? Okay.
Yes.
I didn't know if this was just, like, a weird Tom Cruise thing.
No, definitely. Okay. Also, I found out that... I don't know if it was in 5 or 6. I don't remember which one. But in one of those, Rebecca Ferguson and Tom Cruise did kiss, and they cut it out of the movie. I don't know if it was a scripted kiss or if it was, yeah, like, a spur-of-the-moment kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, no, Tom Cruise kisses. And he kisses, you know, Paula Patton in Ghost Protocol. And then, of course, like, in, you know, 3, true, he, like, yeah, you know, has a love interest.
Yeah.
I understand the idea of that, of wanting that character to be kind of celibate, like, and Tom Cruise is weird and, like, not.
Yeah.
But then don't introduce the Ilsa Fisk. Like, it seems, right, like the whole point of introducing that character was to give this character, like, a love interest that it was his equal, that he didn't have to worry about in the same way he worried about Julia, right?
Yeah, that was kind of the arc of the last, like, 2 movies.
Right. I guess.
Even him letting go of Julia, like, bringing, yes, her back in Fallout was to kind of put closure on that so that he could move forward with,
exactly,
Rebecca Ferguson's character. I think they were more interested. The filmmakers were more interested in that tension in the last 2 movies than they, mm-hmm, are in them as an actual relationship. And I think they got so infatuated with the idea of Hayley Atwell's character that they just didn't have a lot for Rebecca Ferguson to do. And they felt like, I don't know if this was consciously, like, we have to kill her off so that Ethan can, you know, chase Grace. Not necessarily in a romantic way, but just, mm-hmm, in a connection way. Ethan can only be connected with one person at a time, kind of a thing, which,
yeah,
feels
one
weird.
Brunette.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah. it felt very much like we have to remove her from the equation so that we can focus on Grace, which I don't think is true, and I don't think is a good idea.
No, I agree. But even if, like, even if you believe that, mm-hmm, if you think, like, okay, there's two, we don't want to share screen time, right? Like, yeah, we want to be focused. I think that there are other creative ways to get her out of the picture for the rest of the movie than killing off the character.
100%. There's so many ways. And again, I feel like people always use the, like, we have to find, you know, we have to show that there are stakes. We have to show that, you know, this thing means business and all,
sure,
of that. It's like, there's so many other ways to do that.
Yes.
This isn't our only option for showing that there are stakes to this story.
Yeah.
We already, yeah, believe there are stakes to this story. We've seen these movies so many times. Like, we,
right,
know what's at stake.
Right. I'm just really mad about it. And
same.
It's really, like, I still had an amazing time at this movie and I still love these movies, but it really has hampered, like, my joy.
I feel you. I feel less joy around this movie, even though I really enjoyed it and I like it a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just like, I keep using the word baffled because it's not even just that I'm mad. I'm like, I'm really confused about, like, why they would do this. Other than,
yeah,
like you said, like, Rebecca Ferguson wants out. That's the only thing that, mm-hmm, really makes sense because she is a beloved character, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like a weird choice.
Yep.
I don't think they're going to do a Tom Cruise, Hayley Atwell romance.
Ugh, they better not.
But if they do, I will riot.
Yeah. I will be furious.
Yeah. Because of my, like, devotion to the Ilsa Faust character.
Yeah.
But also because what I did love about this movie is their dynamic, the dynamic, mm-hmm, between Tom Cruise and Hayley Atwell,
yeah,
and how paternal it was.
Reed. Her learning to, like, actually trust him, him opening up to her. Like, there was just so much there that feels, it would feel like a betrayal to turn it into a romantic relationship.
Yes. the scene, well, we're going to talk about, like, stunts and,
yes,
like, what we loved.
Yeah.
But the scene of them driving together,
I loved
how it felt like he was, like, teaching her how to drive. Like, very,
yeah,
father-daughter.
Yeah, agreed.
And like the scene and the train, like when she's like scared and he's saying like, don't look down.
Yeah.
Like
he's that pushing her through. Yeah.
Right. Feels like, again, very like fatherly, protective, you know,
which was another thing that I kind of liked in the third Mission Impossible movie, where he has that relationship. He's the trainee mentor. Or mentor-mentee relationship that he has with, what's her name?
Carrie Russell.
Carrie Russell, yes.
Yeah, big time.
I like that. Like, with the age that Tom Cruise is now.
Yeah.
I think he could lean into more of that. Which he does well in Top Gun, too. You know, like, I think that's really his sweet spot now.
I have a question. Has Tom Cruise ever played a father?
That is a great question.
Kind of weird, yes. Right?
Yes, in American Made.
Okay. I've never seen that.
It's a bad movie, but he does have like little kids that are barely in the movie, but technically his character has kids.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah. Kind of. I mean, he's a weirdo. So it's just kind of, you know, kind of strange.
Oh, War of the Worlds, right?
I've never seen that either.
Okay.
He does have.
I think Dakota Fanning is his daughter in that one.
Got it. That kind of makes sense.
But again, recently, like within the last 20 years, honestly, he's moved away from all of that.
Right. Right. Yeah, but so yeah, I mean, those are my two biggest complaints is like the villains don't make a ton of sense. And also, okay, going back to the entity, when you have AI that has infiltrated every digital thing in the world,
yeah,
you're just asking for so much, like every time they used anything that had any kind of computer, I was like, why are you using that thing? Like, the entity is going to infiltrate it, you know?
Yeah, it didn't affect their, like, how they were reacting to some of this in a way that I thought it would. It'd be like, we're getting rid of computers, we're getting off walkie-talkies, we're not touching anything, we're going old school.
Right.
And kind of they just did their normal thing. Like, right. Uh-oh, he's everywhere, good luck.
Yeah, like when he pulls out that gadget that says safe house, safe boat, safe car.
Yeah.
One, that made me laugh, that those were, like, the three things a spy needs.
Yeah. You just have an app. I assume somebody's just, you know, keeping that thing up to date, like Airbnb.
Yeah. But I also love that those were the only three options.
Yeah.
Like, not, like, passport, like, airplane tickets, like,
yeah.
Just boat, house, car. Anyway, like, when he used that, it's like, okay, but the entity could be infiltrating that. Or when Benji... like gets into the passenger seat and lets the car drive
itself.
I know,
right? With that, what he's talking about, like, I think that's very funny of him, like, talking about the AI taking over while he's, you know, getting in the passenger seat of a self-driving car. But that did bring a little bit of stress into my life in a way that didn't make sense.
Well, and it's just like, again, we expect these people to be the smartest people in the world,
right?
Ultimately, right? Because they're able to do all these missions and so when they make mistakes that seem so obvious, it's really frustrating.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's just so sticky to have that be your villain. Yeah, I guess those are my big issues. Ilsa Faust dying and the entity.
I agree. I do not think that the Mission Impossible franchise has had great villains in general for the movies.
Yeah.
But they've been at least understandable. In a simple way.
Yeah.
I think some of the more interesting villains are some of like the secondary villains. Like technically Philip Seymour Hoffman. Why was it so hard? was the secondary villain to
Billy Crudup.
Billy Crudup. He was just the middleman.
Who I also love in that movie.
Oh yeah,
though.
He's great. He's great.
Yeah.
Henry Cavill is a secondary villain to Solomon Lane. So like all of these, I think in this movie is kind of plays second fiddle.
Yeah.
And it's just all of them are more interesting. And I'm just like, if you could put some more time into those characters and let us just sit with them like we did in the last movie, we spent so much time with Henry Cavill.
Yeah.
It just made the movie way more fun.
Yeah.
So, let's talk about the stunts.
Yes. Okay. Let's do it.
There were a couple different featurettes that came out before the movie came out. One was the featurette about the jump. One was the featurette about them driving in Rome. And the third was the featurette about like the fight at the nightclub. Had you seen any of those before?
Not at all. I definitely seen a lot of press about the jump.
Yeah.
I remember hearing like that was the first thing that they filmed because he was like, yeah, if it doesn't work, like, good to know at the beginning.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So other than that, I really didn't know. The only other thing I had seen before the movie was in a trailer. There is a shot that is so cool of when Hayley Atwell and Tom Cruise are in the train car and like the gravity shifts and like all the stuff flies up, you know? That shot was in the trailer, and I remember in the trailer being like, damn, that's cool.
Yeah, because I hadn't watched any of the trailers or the featurettes, I did not know. Mostly, I didn't know about the jump. And so going into that happening, I was just shocked. I feel like I was the only one in the theater who was just like, I can't believe this is happening. I can't believe this is happening. I don't think it's as compelling as some of the other stunts in Fallout. Because it's not a simple stunt, but it's one thing. You're going off a cliff on a motorcycle and then parachuting. Not to take away from the complexity of it. It's just as far as like the wow moments in this movie. It is a wow moment, but it's not. I don't think it lives up to some of the heights of Fallout.
Yeah, I guess like the thing in these Mission Impossible movies, there's like big sequences, right? And then like individual stunt, right?
Yeah.
So like. Motorcycle chases are like their whole sequence that are so exciting. And then there's like the one big stunt that Tom Cruise does like by himself. Right.
Yep.
And so if we're comparing those, I don't think anything will beat the Burj Khalifa for me. Like that's going to be, I think, the top tier.
I agree with you there.
Of all of them. But just the image of his body being upright in the air and the motorcycle falling beneath him is so cool. Like, they've used that as a poster for this movie, is just that image. Mm. And it's compelling.
Yeah, I really loved that jump. I just think one of the things that that's simplified about it is he's jumping, he's going to pull his chute, and then he gets on the train.
Right. There's no nothing happens in the middle.
Right. In a lot of his other stunts, it is a part of like the stunt that like something goes wrong and he has to adjust and like all of these things.
Right.
Which just adds to the tension during while you're watching it. Whereas this is just an amazing feast of your eyes just to be like, wow, look at this. He did it.
Totally.
I did love the whole train sequence. Everything about the train was just fun to watch. The fight on top. The fights inside, the jumping between train cars, like all of that, I really enjoyed.
I mean, the never-ending falling train cars.
Oh my gosh.
Of like every time they make it out of a train car, the new train car starts falling.
Yeah,
was genius and so incredible to watch. That image of like when they're in the car with the piano and. That's at the point where like Hayley Atwell is like holding on to Tom Cruise and he's like, you gotta let go of me. And she keeps like grabbing him. Really, really good. Oh my God. And the train car where they had to, go through the kitchen and all the oil
and
I guess my panic in that was that like the oil from the fryer kept sloshing and I didn't know if it was hot oil or not.
I was thinking the exact same thing. I was like, is this gonna burn and disfigure our characters?
Right. Like that was so terrifying. Like it's so funny. It's such a genius little element to be like the terror of a train falling off a cliff, off a bridge, right? Is like the immediate, and then there's also hot oil nearby. And you're like kind of equally terrified by both. Right?
Yeah. Yeah,
that was incredible. I want to talk to you about so many similarities I saw between this movie and the Fast franchise.
Yes. Starting with the car chase in Rome.
Yeah, car chase in Rome. Like, how wild that both of those movies this year had car chases in Rome.
Yeah.
There was that. There was also just the fact that, like, obviously, Mission Impossible has had motorcycle and car chases before. Like, that's not new. But I do feel like this was, like, the first time it was so car-focused. You know what I mean? For, like, that extended period of time. which made me think about Fast in general, not just the most recent one, but just in general. Like, it felt like a Fast sequence. And it made me, and it was incredible. I honestly think it might have been my, well, one of, not my favorite part of the movie, but it was really up there. Mm-hmm. And I loved the gimmick of having Hayley Atwell and Tom Cruise handcuffed to each other and switching between passenger and driver. And it made me think, like, how has the Fast franchise not done that yet? Like, how did they not think of that?
Yeah. I feel like they've done handcuffed to cars before, but not handcuffed to each other. I do think those are the things that make these movies fun, is when you take a stunt and you're just like, how do we twist this in a weird way? Like the being handcuffed to the car, like in Fallout when his oxygen mask or his oxygen tank gets unplugged. And Henry Cavill gets struck by lightning during the fall. Like, all of those things that's like little complications in the midst of this that are just going to elevate these stunts.
Yeah. I particularly like the idea of, like, Hayley Atwell being a bad driver and being forced to be in the driver's seat. And again, in Fast, we've seen someone who doesn't know how to drive, drive. But we've never, but in those scenes, I liked the idea of having a good driver in the car with them, like taking over the wheel and them and one person handling the brakes, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And everything about it was incredible. I loved Tom Cruise. I like when Tom Cruise panics, like when he gets nervous or panics. And when Hayley, when he was telling her, like, which way to go, and she would, like, turn the wrong way, he'd be like, okay, fine, we can go this way.
Him not having it all together are the best parts of these movies.
Yeah. Yeah, so good. Another thing about that reminded me of Fast is that train falling sequence was very similar to in Seven when Brian is having to go up through the bus as the bus is falling off the cliff.
Yes. Yeah, I thought the same thing.
I guess it's just so interesting. I also rewatched the original three Bourne movies recently. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see how these franchises inspire each other and steal from each other, ultimately, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Bond, Impossible, Bourne, Fast. Are there any others I'm missing?
I think those are the big ones in the action franchise.
Yeah. Where there's like a main dude, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I don't have as many like individual stunts that I want to go through, but I do want to kind of go through different like major sequences and set pieces. Particularly, I think honestly, my favorite part in the whole movie. Well, let me just say that my favorite scene in the whole movie is when the team splits up and is fleeing the airport. The music is just so good. I think the music's great in this whole movie, but in that particular scene, it feels so big and the drama is just turned up to a 10. I just love, it felt glamorous and dramatic and exciting all at once. I loved the music and them all fleeing in different directions in that scene.
It felt like such a good Mission Impossible scene. Like, it felt very classic. We're doing Mission Impossible. We've got the whole crew, and it's a great way to set up and start this movie.
You have Tom Cruise running.
Yeah, you get plenty of Tom Cruise running in this movie. But I loved everything about the airport. There's so much going on, so many people that we're tracking.
Yeah.
And they do a really good job of making sure that you know where everybody is, who's talking to who. Like, it's just a really well done sequence.
Yeah. Sorry, my thoughts are a little all over the place. But one other thing I do want us to talk about in general is Hayley Atwell's character, Grace.
Yeah.
And how I really, really love that her character doesn't immediately just start working with Ethan. That, like, she doesn't immediately trust him or, like, you know, become part of the team. That it really takes time to earn her trust and that... I love how many times she betrays Ethan. Like, I love how many times she tries to escape Ethan and Ethan's still like, God, I'm going to still keep trying to work with you and protect you, you know? Yep.
That's hilarious. That's one of Rebecca's least favorite things about this movie. She was constantly just like, the fact that she did not get on board sooner is killing me.
Oh, I loved and it.
In my mind, it's like, I mean, if I were in her situation, I would probably also run. But I totally get, like, we have been with Ethan for so long that we're just like, yeah, you can trust this guy. Just please, right. Just trust this guy.
Yeah. I do. And I also like that, like, one, I think it makes sense that you shouldn't trust this random stranger that is, you know,
right,
getting you into all this danger. But also, I like the idea that her whole life, her main objective is, how do I escape? Like,
yeah,
how do I steal, and then how do I escape? Mm-hmm. And she doesn't even understand the concept, like, in her bones of, like, how do I work with someone? And so even if she might kind of trust Ethan, like, she just has to escape him whenever she sees the opportunity present itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found her performance to be so special. The fact that if anyone can hold screen time with Tom Cruise, that's impressive, right? Because he's Tom Cruise. But for her to join his Mission Impossible franchise,
yeah,
and have the movie be almost equally hers, it felt like, it was miraculous to me.
I agree with that. Hate that it has to come at the...
Agreed.
At the death of Ilsa Faust.
Right. But, agreed. I'm trying to think of other things that, like, really stuck out to me.
How did you feel about the train sequence with her selling the key? Like, her, basically Vanessa Kirby, who we haven't talked about at all.
We need to talk about Vanessa Kirby.
Playing Hayley Atwell.
Yeah.
I love Vanessa Kirby. I think she's great in these movies. Too. I thought this one particularly, like, it was such an interesting portrayal. Because, again, you're Vanessa Kirby, you're playing Hayley Atwell, playing you.
Right.
Like, it's a very deep and layered performance, and I just thought she was really great in this.
Vanessa Kirby, introduced in the last movie, loved her in the last movie. Like, I love this character and how, like, I love how she has this flirtatious, like, sexual energy with every person she talks to.
Yeah.
And I love that the combination of her being, like, this British charm with, like, villainous, like, I will kill anyone, I do not care, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Mindset. I think that's, like, really fascinating to watch, and Vanessa Kirby is so good at it. And then in general with Mission Impossible movies, the face mask thing will never get old for me. One, because the surprise reveals are always so fun. But even when it's not a surprise, when we know a person's wearing a mask, it is so fun to watch an actor essentially play two characters at once, right? Mm-hmm. I loved when Philip Seymour Hoffman got to do it in Three, when he got to be Ethan Hunt, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, the fact that other actors, the Tom Cruise, get to play Ethan Hunt is cool.
It is, yeah.
And so, yeah, that scene really worked for me. I loved when she got out of the train car and she says to her brother, and he says, you know, you changed, referring to her outfit. And she goes, and you never will.
Yeah, you never will. Yeah.
So great. I love that she, you know, came up with a White Widow line, you know? Yeah. And I do think that the exchange with Kittredge, when she makes that misstep of saying, like, I did a job, she did a job. That felt a little amateurish to me.
Yep.
And the kind of thing that, like, maybe the CIA director would pick up on. So I didn't love that little detail, but otherwise loved her in that scene. Yeah.
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I love all of the characters in these movies. I think they're just doing a really good job of, like, fleshing this out with interesting people. I have absolutely no idea who Shea Whigham is playing
in this movie.
He's trying to track Ethan Hunt down as a member of the community, apparently.
Is that what it's called?
For the capital C community.
How funny.
Yeah.
I was just assuming it was CIA this whole time.
I don't know if that's what that means, but
especially,
like,
because, like, on the train he goes, like, Kittredge, like, it seems like you're my boss. Why is my boss on the train?
Yeah.
You know?
So I don't know I feel like the somebody else was part of the community. I feel like that came up again.
I've never heard of the community. I've watched all of these movies.
They just kept saying community.
I'm Googling
and
I
don't know what that means. Is it U.S. intelligence community? Is that what this is? I just Googled.
I just see on Instagram, welcome to the community, Rob Delaney. Like,
I wonder if it's the intelligence community. So, like, because all those people are part of, like, the NRO, JSOC, DIA, NSA,
yeah, CIA. I guess United States just, intelligence community.
Yeah, it's just all the community.
Okay.
Okay, well, that was confusing. You're right. He probably is, like, CIA.
Yeah.
Agent, but the whole time I was just like, so who does he work for?
Yeah.
Until the end when he runs into Kittredge.
Right, but then there's also, they seed that, like, he might know Ethan or have some sort of connection to Ethan.
Yeah.
That seems like something they're seeding for the next movie.
Yeah. I hope we find out more.
Yeah.
But yeah, overall, I would say I really enjoyed this movie. I don't like that it's a part one because I really want to talk about the story as a whole. And I feel like I really won't truly know how I feel about this movie until the next movie comes out.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense. Mostly, I really just want to stress again how I do think my most surprising and favorite part of this movie was Palm Clemente's performance.
She was
so cool.
I am excited that she's going to be in the next movie.
Yes, it seems like that's the case. Yeah. I'm excited about that, too. I wonder what that means, though. Like, because, again, this is my problem with not understanding why these people are working for the entity.
Yeah.
It's like, what drew her character to that? Yeah. And, like, is that something that can be reversed, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Very, very strange. But I still adored these movies, and I can't wait for the next one, and...
Same.
Yeah.
And I'm excited to rewatch it. You said you enjoyed it the second time than the first, or?
I think so. I think the first time I was really trying to wrap my head around the entity so much that it was so confusing. And it was just kind of like that you spent so much time focusing on trying to figure that out that that I didn't get to enjoy the movie as much, you know?
Yeah.
And so the second time around, I really just got to enjoy how good the filmmaking was.
Yeah.
Because I wasn't bothered by the entity.
I'm excited about that.
Yeah.
Cool.
All right. Well, one July release down, two more to go.
I know. Here we go. Barbenheimer. Is that it? I keep wanting to say Boppenheimer.
I think it's
Boppenheimer is more fun. But
the first thing I heard was Boppenheimer, and now I think people are saying Barbenheimer.
Barbenheimer, I think, makes it a little more equal. But
Yeah,
I'm excited. Cool. Well, I think that about wraps it up for us. You can find me on Letterboxd at Lucas and Stuff.
And you can find me on all social media platforms at Sandra Amstutz. My last name is spelled AMSTUTZ.
Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Goodbye now. Goodbye.
Go away. I'll see you soon, okay?
That's it. Go home.
Yep.
Moving along, Padre.
Goodbye, old friend.
That's it. That's our show for tonight, people.